Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and it's time to do the roundup. Governor Chris Sununu ends speculation on a Senate run, announcing he'll seek a third term as governor. The Democratic field of presidential contenders just keeps growing. And after passing in the House, a bill legalizing recreational marijuana hits a major roadblock. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them in this hour. Give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your questions or comments at our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. That's all one word, and you'll find us. And you'll also find a live streaming video of this radio broadcast. Very easy to listen and watch. Again, Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester Inklink and in-depth NH.org series that explores stories from the New Hampshire State House, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and Paul Steinhauser, New Hampshire political reporter for the Concord Monitor, Seacoast Online, and nationally for Fox News. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Peter.
Again, listeners, phone number for you to call to join the conversation. Burning questions on your mind, stories that you really think we should talk about today, stories you want to weigh in on. The number is 1-800-892-6477. So the big news this week is that Governor Chris Sununu says that he's not going to run for Senate. He is going to run for a third term as governor. And here's what he had to say about it this week.
I don't know what they do in Senate, the Senate, frankly. They don't do much. So I can't imagine going to Washington and being one of 100 senators that doesn't really get a whole lot done.
So that's Governor Sununu sort of explaining why he doesn't want to run for Senate this time around. Dean, your thoughts on the governor's decision?
Yeah, this was not a big surprise to me, although it was fun to speculate a bit about whether or not he was going to challenge Dean Shaheen and what that might mean for an open governor's seat. A little bit of what he said there in the opening comment about not getting anything done in the Senate. We're seeing both parties having some issues with recruiting people to run for the U.S. Senate. It's become increasingly gridlocked, much in the same way that the U.S. House of Representatives has experienced issues in recent years. So it's often the case that that politicians prefer to be chief executive, even if it's just as a state, or perhaps run for president, as a number of governors are now doing for the Democratic nomination. So, this was my expectation. It would have been a really interesting race if he had challenged Dean Shaheen. They're both popular politicians. He had extremely high approval rating. His approval rating has come down a bit. It's still high, but it's come down a bit. Dean Shaheen still has the support of, majority, just over a majority of New Hampshire citizens. So it would have been a really good race. And the implications for the governor's seat and who might run for that were just fascinating, but for all the toying with this idea of a Senate race, I'm not surprised to see that he's going to go for a third term.
What are your thoughts, Paul Steinhauser?
No surprise for those of us who cover campaign politics here in New Hampshire on a daily basis. Yeah, we knew, talking to our sources, that he was going to run for governor again, run for a third term for re-election. What I found most interesting, and this, he put it out in a statement on Tuesday night at the same time that he then went to a big fundraiser to raise money for his re-election. He really went after Shaheen again in the statement, which was a surprise because here you're announcing your re-election. You want to talk about that. In his statement, he said, "We all know that I would defeat Dean Shaheen," repeating what he said a couple times in recent weeks. Then he went on to say, "Never before has a sitting 12-year senator from New Hampshire accomplished so little." I mean, that's a That's an in-your-face comment. No doubt about it. There is no love lost between the Shaheens and the Sununus. That's clear. Remember, Gene Shaheen and his older brother, John E. Sununu, battled it out in two epic Santa campaigns in 2002 and 2008. But it was interesting that he put that in there. The next day, he did give her a couple of credits, but again, took another shot at her. Finally, as Dean said, it leaves the Republicans with no real right now formidable candidate to take Shaheen on in what could have been, you know, Republicans were hoping that this would be a seat that maybe they had a shot at winning back. It's a purple state. But right now, it doesn't seem like that. The two names that are out there, I spoke to former State House Speaker Bill O'Brien. Everybody remembers him. He is moving towards it. That's what he told me. And WMUR, I'm definitely moving towards
it. Moving towards thinking about a run.
Oh, yeah. And he was putting, he said no real timetable, but he said he needed to get organized probably by this summer. So he is seriously thinking about it. He's out there making the moves right now, the early moves. Then the other name out there, retired Major General Bulldog, Donald Bulldog from Stratham. Here is a guy who nobody really knows in New Hampshire politics, but is also moving towards a run.
What about Kelly Ayotte? People often mention her as possibly wanting to become a senator again. No?
Not in this cycle. There is no way Kelly Ayotte, from everybody who's close to her when I want to talk to them, she's not running in 2020. Maybe 2022 in a rematch with her and Maggie Hassan. Stay tuned for that, but she's not going to be running in 2020.
And that was part of the fun of speculating was that if Sununu had run for Senate, might Kelly Ayotte step in and try to run for governor? We don't know. She's busy doing a lot of other things right now. The other issue for Sununu has been fundraising. And Gene Shaheen has built up a pretty significant war chest. He's had issues on and off previously with fundraising. He's not a big fan of it, but it's something that right now, anyway, given the way campaigns are funded, you need to do. There'd be a lot of outside money for sure. There would have been a lot in the Senate race if he had gotten in from Republican national entities. So that was a challenge for him as well. You know, Gene Shaheen, when she was reelected in 2014. That was the year that the Obama administration lost control of the U.S. Senate. She was one of the few bright spots for Democrats in what was a very difficult midterm election for them. General presidential elections, general election years for presidents like 2020 tend to be a little bit better for Democrats in terms of turnout. So I think that would help her a little bit. But there's no doubt, while I don't necessarily agree with his assessment that he would have beaten her for sure, it would have been a very interesting race.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
The next big question, obviously, now that we got the Senate out of the way, is, okay, which Democrats are going to now run?
Challenge Chris Sununu. Yeah.
Okay, well, the two names we've been talking about for months now, they continue to move towards launching campaigns, most likely, and that is the Senate Majority Leader, State Senate Majority Leader Dan Feltes from Concord. There's another person from Concord who's also really moving towards that, and that is the executive counselor, Andrew Valinsky. And then finally, don't forget about Steve Marchand, who the former Portsmouth mayor. He ran in 16 and 18 for the nomination.
Third time around for Steve.
The third time. I spoke to him yesterday. He had an event at the Legislative Office Building. It looked like a campaign event. He was talking about abortion and trying to codify abortion rights in the state. And I asked him about a 2020 run, and he said, listen, I have obviously not ruled it out. He very much sounded like he's running again. Molly Kelly, the 2018 Democratic gubernatorial nominee, has not ruled it out either, and she continues to dabble in politics, continues to fundraise for her political action committee. And finally, Joyce Craig, the Manchester mayor, running for re-election this year. Keep your eyes on her. I don't think it would happen in 20, maybe in 22, but keep your eyes on her as well.
I didn't hear you mention Donna Susie. Is she a possibility as well?
I don't think so. From the people I talk to, Gary would know better on that, but she seems to be enjoying her job right now as Senate President.
She's very happy right now as being the Senate President, I think. That's the whole issue. And to talk about Steve Marchand, he sent out a fundraising letter about a week ago, which, it certainly looked like he was setting up a campaign for governor.
And he, at least the last time around, declared rather early, so perhaps that's a strategy he'd be willing to repeat.
Any way you look at it, it's going to be a delicious Democratic gubernatorial primary battle here in New Hampshire.
Only Paul Steinhauser would describe it as delicious, but I hear you, Paul. I hear you. It sounds fascinating. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're talking about the news of the week, and we're going to turn our attention now to 2020 presidential candidates. A lot of them to talk about, but if you've got one in mind that you really want us to talk about, you have a question about or a comment about, we really want to make this opportunity available to you. So give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email. We love to hear from you that way as well. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Making headlines this week, of course, was former Vice President Joe Biden, who was in the state. He recently declared that he was going to run for president. And here's a clip of him talking about why.
You know in your gut, this is maybe the most important election any one of you ever participated in, no matter how young you are or how old you are. And I mean it not because I'm running,
but because of the nature of where we find ourselves today. The core values of these nations, our very standing in the world, everything that's made America America, I believe, is at stake. And we know why. Limited to 4 years, this president and his administration will go down as an aberrant moment in American history. But given 8 years, this president will forever and fundamentally change the character of this nation.
That's former Vice President Joe Biden speaking this week in New Hampshire. So, Paul Steinhauser, how is former Vice President Joe Biden selling himself here? He's got a lot of history. What's the marketing campaign he's making for himself now?
You know that he is the candidate who can beat Donald Trump. That's part of it because he takes it, you know, he focuses his attacks on Trump. And he obviously touts his experience and what he's done in his many, many years, almost four decades as senator from Delaware, and then 8 years, obviously, as he calls it, Barack Obama's wingman as serving as vice president. It was a good trip for him. He had a 2-day swing. It was his first year in New Hampshire since announcing in late April, but also it was his first trip in New Hampshire, first public events in New Hampshire in more than 2 years. Mm-hmm. And it went well. No major gaffes. He had good events. The first one kicking off at the Community Oven, a popular restaurant, pizza restaurant in Hampton on Route 1. An oversized crowd there. Then he went up to Somersworth, got an endorsement. And it was actually a good one. Dana Hilliard, the first openly gay mayor in New Hampshire, endorsed him in the Rainbow City. And then a big rally Monday night at Manchester Community College. And Tuesday, right here in Concord at the Bagel Works, a place he had stopped at three or four years ago, back in 2015, and then onto a Nashua House Party. A good trip. He did probably his longest back-and-forth gaggle with reporters that he has done since he's launched his campaign. He pushed back against criticism from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other progressives about him not doing enough on the environment. Made some news there. Made some news on the crime bill, the 1994 crime bill. It was overall a good trip for him here in New Hampshire.
Is there any particular policy position or something else that he's sort of pinning his argument that I am the one that can beat Donald Trump on? Is there something that he's really hammering home?
You know, overall, no. I mean, he's not harping on any one thing yet. He's laying out his agenda as we speak. In fact, when he pushed back against the criticism on the environment, on battling climate change, he teased that he'll have a big speech later this month on that issue. So he really hasn't been laying out policy yet. It's more laying out his vision for the country to get the country back on course and to get the White House back mm-hmm. on course.
Dean?
Yeah, when political scientists talk about why voters choose particular candidates, sometimes they look at what we call true preference voting, which is finding a candidate that most closely reflects your ideological positioning on various issues. But we also look at what's called strategic voting, which basically is the premise that you'll take whichever candidate from your party can beat the nominee from the other party. Basically, the idea is that you want to get someone in there who can win. And there's a lot of polling data right now that shows that Democrats are preoccupied with the idea of beating Donald Trump. And so to get to Paul's comment, no, this Biden right now is not an issue driven campaign. This is a strategic voting campaign. Biden is saying, I'm the guy who can beat Donald Trump. And this is a time honored tradition. Every primary that I've observed up here, there are candidates who make the issue that it's all about their ability to beat the nominee of the other party. And that's really what's driving it. And what's been so fascinating for me is to watch over the last month the tremendous amount of angst that this has generated among progressives in the activist base of the party. If you go back about a month ago and you look at some of the analysis where Biden was at about 21% and Bernie Sanders was at 20%, then progressives were saying, well, as soon as Biden gets in, he's going to plummet. The 21% is his upper limit. He's going to start to plummet. He's now at like 36%. And this has really caused a tremendous amount of concern among progressives who thought that this was going to be an election about progressive ideas, ideological purity, whole issues revolving around diversity and gender and representation, that this was going to be fresh and new and different. Now they find themselves stuck in this conversation about whether or not Biden is the only one who can beat Donald Trump. And in my experience, anecdotally from talking to progressives around the state, it's really driving them crazy, and they don't quite know what to do. Now it may change as we get into the fall, but right now this is all about Biden and whether or not he's able to beat Trump, and that's not where progressives want to be at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Paul.
There is that hunger to get Trump out of the White House. I hear it all the time on the campaign trail when I talk to Democrats. And you look at the national and state polling as well. The top thing for Democrats is find somebody who can beat Trump. One other thing about Biden, so far, and his so far, he's come out of the gate extremely strong. His poll numbers are going up, not down, here in New Hampshire and nationally and in the other early voting states. The other thing is, other than that pushback against Ocasio-Cortez, which was interesting, he's basically staying out of it. He's not engaging. He's running a general election campaign so far in the primaries. He's not responding to attacks by Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and other more progressive contenders for the nomination. Right now, he's not doing that. He has luxury now of not doing that. But remember, in the end of June comes the first national debates. He's going to be face-to-face with these people. Then he's going to have to respond and defend
himself.
But he
will also benefit from the fact that there are going to be 24 people vying to be on that debate stage. And so at some point, the debate exchange is going to be almost meaningless. It's going to take a little bit longer until some people drop out, where you'll start to see maybe some more direct clash with Biden. But there's no doubt that, as you said, progressives are getting antsy. There's a lot of angst. They're starting to go after him a little more directly.
Mm-hmm. Another of the 2 dozen candidates running for president. I wish I were exaggerating, but that's actually 2 dozen.
Literally.
Is Senator Cory Booker. He was in New Hampshire this week. A high school sophomore at a Littleton event told Senator Booker she wouldn't be old enough to vote in next year's presidential election, but she said her New Hampshire community needed more funding to fight substance abuse, including for support groups and rehabilitation facilities. So we have some tape. These are the kinds of questions political candidates face in New Hampshire.
What would you do to help rural communities in the face of the substance abuse crisis? Because we don't get resources, we don't get money, and it's just...
So before I tell you what I would do, I want to learn from you. What would you think we should be doing?
We need more resources. We need funding. We need people to come up here and listen to people. We need AA groups. We need substance abuse groups. We've got the Serenity Center across the street, but we've only got like 4 rehabs in the entire state that are live-in. And like 3 of them are men only, and the one that's women only has only like 17 beds or something like that. So we just need a lot of resources up here, and we're not getting them.
So that's exactly what I know. I live in a community where we see a lot of this problem as well, another, as I said, a low-income community. And so it's not just resources. We need to be investing heavily in evidence-based interventions that we know actually work.
So that's Senator Cory Booker speaking with a high school sophomore at a Littleton event this week. Paul Steinhauser, your thoughts on
that? You're hearing a lot of questions about the opioid crisis on the campaign trail. Continued. Here's the beautiful thing about New Hampshire. Back in the 2016 campaign, Hillary Clinton comes up here, her first stop in April of 2015, and she had a roundtable discussion in Keene. Guess what the first questions were all about? The opioid crisis. New Hampshire. And the opioid crisis was known in New Hampshire and other states back then, but it wasn't really known nationally. New Hampshire did a very good job in awakening the rest of the nation to the fact that this opioid crisis was really hurting and hurting badly back in 2015. It continues to be the case in 2020.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you make of Cory Booker in general? Like, how are his policies? Is he spelling them out in any specific way?
Oh, yeah. In fact, just last week, he put out a big policy proposal on battling gun violence, which was a little different than the others because he called for the federal licensing of all gun owners, which is a little separate from what others are asking about or proposing. Listen, Booker's doing everything right. He's up here a lot. He's very good on the campaign trail, a great orator, but taking questions, big crowds at his town halls and house parties. He's not really popping in the polls right now. Don't worry, we got 8.5 months to go until the voting. Maybe you want to pop a little later in the year.
Worth mentioning that the NHPR and Iowa Public Radio have teamed up with the NPR Politics podcast team to interview the 2020 candidates. And the first episode in the series was released this week with NHPR's Casey McDermott and NPR Scott Detrow interviewing Cory Booker in Concord. You'll be able to hear parts of these episodes on Weekend Edition Saturday, starting with that Booker interview tomorrow morning. That's from 8 to 10 on NHPR. And, of course, the NPR Politics podcast you can find wherever you get your podcasts. Dean, I wanted to ask you, because Senator Cory Booker is also a former mayor. He's mayor of Newark, New Jersey. He's not the only mayor running for president. I mean, we have Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana. Your thoughts on all these mayors running for president?
Yeah, well, and Cory Booker is a great example of how you might fold that into your campaign for president. I had a chance to sit down with Cory Booker on Monday as part of the Pints and Politics interview series, and you can find the link to that audio file on my Twitter feed at Dean Spiliotis. And so I had a chance to spend a solid hour talking with him in depth, and very thoughtful in terms of policy. To get to your question, he's really good at kind of bringing in his own experience living in this inner city community in Newark, and he's had real kind of street level or grassroots level experience dealing with these problems. So he's able to relate questions of opioid abuse or healthcare concerns or whatever the particular education, whatever the particular domestic policy issue is, much in the same way Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, does this as well. But Cory Booker does it with a real tremendous kind of power and empathy, and I thought that was probably one of the more effective aspects of his campaign. That said, you know, he not quite getting the traction I think people thought he might have thus far. It may happen at some point. He's certainly putting in the time on the ground here in New Hampshire. He's one of these politicians who will stay until the very last selfie has been taken. Very engaging, a lot of policy ideas. Really kind of on the cusp, though, of being sort of swallowed up by the mass of candidates. He's right on that kind of borderline 3-4 percentage point. So we'll see. But he's also adopted this intentional strategy of not really hitting Trump hard. He's taking more some people say Gandhi-esque kind of approach of not engaging on the negativity. And that works for a while, but there is also this undercurrent in the Democratic Party of people who want candidates to hit Trump hard. So that's something he's going to have to continue to grapple with, where that balance is.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of mayors, what about Mayor Bill de Blasio of New York City, Paul? I mean, he just jumped in. Was that a surprise to you?
No, he had been signaling towards that, but that brings it up to either 23 or 24, and that depends on whether you consider former Alaska Senator Mike Gravel a candidate. A lot of organizations don't count him. Remember, he ran in 08. And
there's also the Miramar, Florida mayor.
Yeah, Wayne Messam is also.
Messam's been here as well.
Yeah, we had two candidates jumping. If you thought the field was big enough already, no, it got bigger this week. You got de Blasio jumping in on Thursday, and earlier in the week you had the Montana governor, Steve Bullock, jump in as well. Bullock visited up here back last summer, and he's preaching that he's a progressive in a very conservative state, touting all his accomplishments that he got done with a Republican-dominated legislature. De Blasio's rollout, probably not the best. A lot of pushback. The New York City media cannot stand him, and they were pointing out all his flaws throughout his launch. So there we are, 23 or 24, historically a record. Yeah. We had 17 Republicans last time around. And now we have way more than that.
Probably every clip I saw of de Blasio in the last 48 hours also had the famous New York City pizza rat, the rat carrying the piece of pizza down into the subway. So he's got to deal with that as well.
Okay. Kamala Harris, U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, visited this week, her third trip to the state. She, while she was here, criticized a newly passed Alabama law that would ban nearly all abortions. She said that as president, she would work to protect what she calls a fundamental issue.
A president can respect a woman's right to choose. A president can use the bully pulpit and the bouquet of microphones that is in front of her at any given moment to be a leader on an issue that directly impacts the health and well-being of women in our country.
So Kamala Harris speaking about the Alabama law. Given this push by several states to ban abortion or pass anti-abortion laws, how likely is this issue to be front and center when Election Day comes, Paul?
It is right now. We'll see how much legs it has, but I think it will. I think it will, especially, you know, with the idea of the Supreme Court justice opening in the next term. I think Democrats will make that a major part. You saw almost every Democrat running for the White House talk about this, push back against the two laws, the one in Georgia and the one in Alabama. And you heard a lot from these candidates about almost like a litmus test. Would they, they would only nominate to the high court nominees who supported and would defend Roe v. Wade. So it's a big issue on the campaign trail. Harris had a pretty good event. She was in Nashua at the Girls Inc. Headquarters. She had a large crowd. She was there to unveil her latest element in her package to push back against gun violence. She talked about banning the import of all assault weapons. And she also, when she had a gaggle later with reporters, she had an interesting way of pushing back against this talk in the media and among pundits that which she would make a good running mate for Joe Biden, which is not sitting well with her in her campaign, considering she's one of the leading contenders, and now people are talking about her being a running mate. She said she turned the tables and said that she thought Biden would make a good running mate for her. So okay. Good trip for her here in New Hampshire.
We got this email from Christopher in Manchester who wrote in to say, if liberals get their way and a far left candidate is the nominee, how will that person pivot and dial it back in autumn 2020? Maybe that'll be the time for an independent candidate to step in to appeal to disenfranchised moderates and undeclared voters, as well as the all-important Democrats in Macomb County and the upper Midwest. That's the comment from Christopher in Manchester. I'll turn to you first, Dean, on that. Sure. So what do you think? How would a far-left nominee reach out to the general electorate in 2020?
Well, I mean, this is the question, and there are competing views of how that would work in a general election. Some people believe that you follow the traditional notion of tacking to the center to pick up independent voters and maybe more moderate, less politically active voters. That's the famous, you win your primaries by going out to the ideological polls on the left and right, and then you move to the center. The competing narrative is one about competitive party mobilization, in which it's really all about turning out as many of your core partisans and true believers as possible. So it really depends on which model you buy into. If you buy into the idea that someone who's out on the liberal wing of the party is going to have to tack into the middle, candidates can do that. It's increasingly difficult in the era of digital and social media because there's always somebody there to remind you of what you said 6 months ago. But others believe that it's really just going to be about turning out the competitive bases to win. In terms of an independent candidate, you know, the high watermark for third-party candidates was Ross Perot in 1992. He got, 18-19% of the vote. In most other elections, independent candidates get a couple percentage points, and inevitably they're blamed for whichever major party nominee loses the general election. So there's always going to be third parties in the mix. It's just very difficult given the way the rules of the game are controlled by the major parties here in the country for a third party to really get any serious traction.
Paul?
Former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, remember earlier this year, made a lot of news here in New Hampshire and nationally with the idea of launching an independent bid. And one of the reasons was he thought that, you know, Trump was too far to the right and that the Democrats could nominate somebody too far to the left. He's kind of cooled that off a little bit now with Joe Biden way up in the polls. But again, we got 8.5 months to go until the primaries begin, so anything can happen.
And he got, to get to my point, he got preemptively pummeled by Democrats who were concerned that he would end up being a spoiler. You know, he'd get a couple percentage points of the vote. Trump would end up winning re-election.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, I know you have to run. You've got a busy schedule given all the candidates you have to chase down. What's going to be a highlight for you over the weekend and then into next week?
Well, we got Elizabeth Warren back in the state this weekend. Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who we really didn't have a chance to talk much about. Jay Inslee, the Washington state governor, who this week unveiled his humongous 10-year, $9 trillion plan to tackle climate change, almost like a Green New Deal. Seth Moulton, the Massachusetts congressman, is up here this weekend. And this is interesting, and I'll be covering this because I work for Fox News as well. Pete Buttigieg is back in the state. He becomes the latest Democrat to do a Fox News town hall. Not a lot of Democrats like Fox News, but a lot of them do watch it, and especially independents. That's going to be in Claremont, which is an interesting choice. It's a town that used to vote heavily Democratic, but last time around in 2016 went narrowly for Donald Trump. And also on the Republican side, Bill Weld, who's been primary challenging the president, will be here. So it's a busy weekend.
Well, Paul Steinhauser, political reporter, thank you very much for being here this part of the show. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck as you're chasing down all the candidates next week. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. We've got so much more to round up for you today. The number is 1-800-892-6477, or send your comments by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, or you can watch a live video of this radio program at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. You can also post a comment while you're there watching. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We will be right back. On Monday on The Exchange, we'll be kicking off a week-long series looking at the state's workforce challenges. So tune into that Monday beginning at 9 on The Exchange on NHPR. But right now we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we've brought in some intelligent people knowledgeable about the state to bring us up to speed, answer your questions if you've got them. In the studio with me now, Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester, Inklink, and In-Depth NH.org series that explores stories from the state.
State House, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And Anna, thanks for joining us this part of the program. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
It's always great to have you here. I wanted to ask you about what happened to the marijuana legalization bill this year, because a Senate committee voted to delay it until 2020. How surprising was that?
Right. This, to me, was not a huge surprise, because a lot of times we see these really big issues getting pushed off after the budget is done. If you look back at the Medicaid expansion debate, they oftentimes tried to combine it with the budget because it was a big spending item, but it would get pushed off in the next year. So that doesn't surprise me a whole lot, especially because we have a certain veto from Governor Sununu. So the legislators that are in favor of legalization are not necessarily that upset by this, because it'll give them a little time to muster more support, particularly in the House, to override that veto.
Mm-hmm. We got a comment from Ray in Dalton on this. Ray wrote in to say, when are the politicians, citizens, and anyone else against its use going to understand that marijuana is with us and is not going away, and the best way to handle its distribution is for the state to control and make the rules about use? That's the comment from Ray in Dalton. Anna, from your research on this, is that a common sentiment?
Well, there's definitely a sense of inevitability, for sure, because, as people have said before, we're an island of marijuana prohibition. We're surrounded by states in Canada where it is going to be legal. And so, at some point, there comes a point where it's saying, all right, we're still going to have people that are driving intoxicated from marijuana from neighboring states. They're getting all the tax revenue. What the heck? We got to jump in. But New Hampshire's going to want to be really thoughtful about it. And there's the idea that we can learn from other states and see what they're doing first.
Mm-hmm. Gary Raynor.
I think part of the problem was the support was going the wrong way on this. It was losing support. It wasn't gaining support. There have been some efforts out there, significant efforts out there to try to tamp this down quite a great deal. Some of it has been characterized as just sort of crackpot, but it's been very effective in pulling away some voters, particularly in the House.
Well, there was that book that came out, right? And it's been a really hot issue.
Yeah. What book are you referring to?
So there was a book that came out that alleges there's a link between marijuana use and psychosis. And it recently came out, but it's been hotly disputed. But it's been gaining a lot of traction among people who are against legalization.
I see. And is that the reason why, Gary,
you
say it's going
the wrong
way?
I mean, has been this real effort that's police chiefs and so on have really made a concerted effort to get out there and contact the senators in particular, saying, we really don't think this is a good idea at all. The other thing I think that might be going on a little bit is a little bit of legislative strategy, where I think there are two things that are going through here with marijuana. One is the homegrown for the medical marijuana folks. And then there's this legalization. And if we pull back legalization, perhaps maybe the governor will let the home grow go through rather than veto it. If you want to put both of them up there, then it's pretty easy to veto both of them. So we might be seeing a little bit of that.
And if you remember back when we originally moved forward in the state on medical marijuana, Governor Hassan had opposed and law enforcement as well, this idea of home cultivation for medical purposes. They thought that would be kind of opening the gateway to personal recreational usage. So, I think the experience of putting medical marijuana into effect in this state was very instructive. It was just a long, difficult process. And so this is another case, and you often see this with state legislatures, where sometimes they trail public opinion a little bit. Public opinion clearly supports legalization, and it is true that we're completely surrounded by other states where it is or is about to be legalized. So I think, as to get to Gary's point about strategic thinking, I think he's right that the issue has been all along is the ability to override a Sununu veto. He's been very clear, I think, that he would veto legalization. And so can you get the two-thirds that you need in both chambers? And I think there was a sense that maybe they need to wait.
So is it a certainty that this bill will come up again in the next session?
It has to come back up.
All right. Other piece of legislation or pieces of legislation that deserve mention is that the legislature passed a bill to add 77 caseworkers to the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. Recent reports by the state's child advocate said this was necessary. And Governor Sununu at first had concerns about this bill, but he announced his intention to sign it. Anna Brown, what was the governor's thought process on this?
So the governor was concerned that we wouldn't be able to fill these positions even if they were funded, because there's been a real problem recruiting and retaining child protective service workers in New Hampshire. It's a really hard job. It's a public job, so the pay isn't amazing. And the idea is if that's money's just sitting there and you aren't hiring people, well, what else could we do in terms of these programs that would have more of a benefit? But Sununu said he heard from the department that hiring had picked up, so he's willing to get on board with this. Although he also did note that, you know, we need to look at this as a big funding appropriation. So SB 6, the one to hire 57 new child protective workers, is $8.6 million. And he said, all right, this is another thing. We're looking at budgeting this year, so you need to take that into consideration, even though I'm going to say okay.
Mm-hmm. So he's announced his intention to sign that. And he also said that he would sign another bill that would create mobile mental health crisis units for children. What are those exactly, Anna?
Sure. So that's Bill SB 14. And New Hampshire already has mobile crisis response teams for adults. And it's the idea that this is another way where we can provide services to people in the community instead of forcing them to go to emergency rooms, institutionalization, all of that. So this is going to be the first one that's just for children.
There's been a lot of talk, a great need for the one for the children or for young people. We had three or four of the mobile units for adults. I mean, these work in a way where you call up and you can get three or four people that will go immediately to somebody and work with them and talk to them and bring them down so that they can be stabilized. And they don't have to go to the emergency room. They don't end up staying there for weeks on end, as we've seen go on. And they can go right into the community mental health system and bring all that. It's been very effective. Mm-hmm. And it's been part of the state's mental health. The new mental health plan is very important. And particularly the child mobile unit has been a particular focus of that plan.
Keeping children in the community. Yeah.
And, you know, it was also part of the lawsuit. This is a way to address a lot of that, what was in the lawsuit that the state settled.
Can you remind us the details of that lawsuit really quickly?
Well, the mental health system was basically sued and say that it has failed. And the state agreed to do a number of things, including these mobile units and various other things, to address the system that had been one of the top in the country, and by the time it got sued, probably one of the worst in the country.
Okay. Thank you for the update on that. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about energy issues, particularly the Northern Pass Project. The project's developer, Eversource, took their appeal of the Site Evaluation Committee's rejection of the project to the state Supreme Court this week. We're going to recap the arguments made on both sides there, but we want to answer your questions, too, if you have them, or if you have comments, we would like to hear them. So give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email works, too. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Two bills aimed at restricting single-use plastics in New Hampshire were rejected in the state Senate this week. That's straws and bags. And Democratic Senator Kevin Kavanaugh had this to say about the legislation.
At this time, I believe that the citizens and businesses of New Hampshire are already turning the tide against plastics. Thus, this legislation seems unnecessary.
So the business community is taking care of it itself, apparently, according to Kevin Kavanaugh. So that's a no-go. Anna, your thoughts on this legislation?
Sure. So this is interesting. Whenever we've asked about individual single-use plastic bags or straws on our Facebook page and our website, people get really up in arms about this. This is a very controversial issue in a way that you might not expect. And so the Senate did decide to basically kill these bills. But they replaced the plastic bag ban with the idea that, all right, now towns are going to have to report on how they're disposing of waste and how they're moving towards the goal of diverting 40% of trash away from landfills and incinerators. So the plastic bag ban bill has been transformed, but it's technically not dead. The senators have to get together with the House, and they're going to have to decide on a compromise version of the bill. Also, what you might see coming up next year, the House is holding on to two bills that would just let towns do local bans on plastic bags or straws. So the issue, even though the Senate kind of said, no, you know, we don't need to get involved. People care about this. This is going on already. The issue isn't completely dead. It's going to be coming back up.
Yeah, this is a big issue, and I think that the change is being driven by businesses and consumers. I've noticed just in the area, if I buy a fountain drink or something, you now get a paper straw often instead of a plastic straw. And at supermarkets, reusable bags are a lot more available. So I think part of this is already being taken care of in the market. Certainly there is a role for state legislatures to perhaps move it along a little bit. But in the end, I think it's going to be a generational change. If you spend any time with teenagers like I do, if they even see you taking a plastic straw or a single-use paper plastic bag, you get some pretty nasty stares. And so so I think that this is going to be, in the end, it'll be a generational change. But I think a lot of businesses that want to be seen as progressive and not lose business are already moving on this.
Okay. Other stories we've reported on this week, the Executive Council rejected a request from Pamela Smart for a chance at freedom on Wednesday. Smart was sentenced to life without parole nearly three decades ago for enlisting her teenage lover to kill her husband. Now 51, Smart has exhausted her appeal opportunities. Also, Senate Democrats are calling on Governor Chris Sununu and Attorney General Gordon McDonald to join 44 other states in a lawsuit alleging that makers of generic drugs have been artificially inflating prices. New Hampshire is just one of six states that has not joined the suit, even though the state did sign on to an earlier lawsuit that came out of the state investigation. And also this week, that would be the red-tailed hawk, the subject of legislation that passed the House a couple of months ago and now passed the House, the Senate rather, this week. The proposal, of course, to make this official state raptor the red-tailed hawk. Anna, your thoughts on the red-tailed hawk?
Oh, there's a storied history on this one. So, yeah, you go back 4 years, some elementary school students brought this bill forward as a class project, basically, and it got slaughtered on the House floor. There were comments that the red-tailed hawk would be a better mascot for Planned Parenthood because of the way it dismembers its prey. We're talking that this was a surprisingly ugly issue. And so the kids, though, they came back. They're in eighth grade now. And now the raptor is officially our state bird.
And the sentiment around this, it seems anyway, is that, come on, fellow legislators, let's just get this through for the kids. They tried so hard. Why not?
Yes. Well, it's interesting because you remember back then when it first went through, there was also sort of a backlash that said, well, if kids are going to be proposing bills, they should propose laws to repeal. They shouldn't be proposing new laws. And so there was the contest for the stupidest law in New Hampshire, which came about the bill that would, there's a ban on collecting seaweed at night. So this is really a hot, ongoing debate in New Hampshire.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we get this on the air. And it's, is Governor Sununu going to sign this, has he indicated?
I feel it would be very strange if he didn't sign
okay.
it.
It would be quite a surprise if he didn't.
Quite a surprise.
I did want to at least get that point covered on this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup this morning, which you can participate in if you have questions or comments. We're going to be talking about energy issues after the break, and we'd love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-892-647. Email exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. We've got a live streaming video of this radio program happening right now, so just search for NHPR Exchange on Facebook. You'll find us there. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
The main reason I decided to incorporate NHPR into my estate planning is because it absolutely is an essential part of my day.
Robert Cody of Deerfield.
Doing so with an IRA account is a very tax-efficient way of transferring your assets to the future.
Fund the future of NHPR by naming us as a beneficiary to your IRA. Learn more about this and other plan giving options at nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester Inc. Link and in-depth NH.org series that explores stories from the State House, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. We're talking about the week's news. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And we wanted to start this part of the program talking about Northern Pass. That was a big deal this week. Gary, you were there for the arguments between Northern Pass developer Eversource and the state, which was, well, the State Site Evaluation Committee, turned the project down, and Eversource took them to court. How were the arguments unfolding this week, Gary?
Well, Eversource is basically saying that the SEC didn't do its job. It didn't finish deliberating the whole thing. And if they had, then they would have seen the benefits. And then they also were saying largely that the SEC did not follow its own rules or the statutes. And it was basically the same argument that they've been putting forth since they've tried to get a rehearing on this after the SEC voted to deny the permit last February. Mm-hmm. And the other side was basically saying that the SEC did the right thing. They did everything that they should have done. They made the right decision. These witnesses that Eversource put up were not credible, and they obviously decided that this was not a project that should go forward, that it would have a very, as they say, unduly adverse effect on the orderly development of the region. Mm-hmm. So the arguments are pretty much the same. What was kind of interesting was the extent to which some of the Supreme Court members were very vocal and very much challenged the Eversource attorney and some of the contentions that they were putting forth, such as that they had to go through all four of the criteria in order to get a permit, and they stopped after the second one when they decided they couldn't pass that. So, Chief Justice Lynn was basically saying, where do you get that from? Hmm. Where is that from? And then he was also insinuating that perhaps that they had the attitude that if we put the application out, then you ought to find a way to approve it and things like that. So it was not, if I was Eversource, all you had to do was kind of look at the Eversource attorneys when they were leaving the building. They didn't look like they were happy.
Okay. And so it's going to take months and months, right, for the state Supreme Court to make a final decision on this?
It may even take a year for the Supreme Court to make a decision on this.
And is the feeling that if Eversource loses this, that they will simply resubmit the project with some details changed with the hopes that it might get through?
Well, Bill Quinlan, the president of Eversource, said afterwards that we would entertain that. He didn't say we would do that. I think they have it's always the case with these sort of things. It's the finances. And if, particularly if the main transmission line goes through and Hydro-Québec electricity is flowing to Massachusetts through the main. I mean, that's a 1,200 volts that they're putting into the England grid. There really isn't there's not enough room for another 1,200 volts mm-hmm. at this point without taking a lot of the existing generating offline. And it makes it very difficult financially to see how that works. And there's also there's a project in Vermont that's already permitted. It's not built. That would also be able to, that would certainly probably get up and running much quicker than going through this whole process again.
Gary, tell us a little bit about one of the other energy stories in the news this week, and that's the Seacoast Reliability Project. It faced a challenge in the state Supreme Court this week. What's going on with the Seacoast Reliability Project?
Well, the Reliability Project was approved by the SEC, but the Conservation Law Foundation and a group of Durham residents have appealed it to the Supreme Court. And both of the appeals are very, very narrow, but they deal with the state's public trust doctrine. I mean, all the public waters in the state, over 10 acres, are thought to be are owned by the people of the state, and they're held in trust by the state for all the people. And because of that, they're saying, both the CLF and the Durham folks, that some aspects of this project, particularly the concrete mattresses that they're going to be putting over the lines in areas where they can't bury them deep enough, that will actually be exposed in low tide, that those needed governor and council approval because of the public trust doctrine. And they didn't seek that, and nobody thought that they should have it. And so it's turning into a real Donnybrook over this whole issue of public trust.
Mm-hmm. Last energy issue we should talk to you about, Gary, and that's the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. The state Senate passed a bill this week that would alter an aspect of the state's REGI program, Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Remind us a little bit first what that is.
Well, the REGI program basically is a cap and trade kind of reduction in carbon emissions, and you get credit for it, and then you can trade them back and forth. If you don't produce enough or if you don't use enough clean energy, then so on, you get it back and forth, and you pay for them. The utilities pay for them, and that all goes into a fund. And it was originally, when this RGGI was established, one of the funds was for efficiency programs, energy efficiency programs. Back in the Bill O'Brien days, it was changed so that all the money went to back to ratepayers, but largely to save the program. That was the whole idea. Well, now, this time, they're going back to having money going into the energy efficiency fund.
Okay. And we've got some other stories to talk about in this hour. I want to get to them all. One of them we should at least mention is that Dartmouth College is challenging the anonymity of plaintiffs in a $70 million class action lawsuit against the college. In the lawsuit alleging the school mishandled complaints of sexual harassment and assault, three of the plaintiffs go by the names Jane Doe 1, Jane Doe 2, and Jane Doe 3. Dartmouth opposes the use of pseudonyms because in their view, they, quote, hinder Dartmouth's investigation of the claims. The firm representing the plaintiffs plans to file a reply to this objection promptly. Also in the news this week, the Manchester Monarchs are ceasing operations after 18 years of professional hockey in New Hampshire's largest city. The team has experienced a drop in attendance in recent years. We also have a story to discuss regarding Mink the Bear. Brita Green on the line with us now. She's been doing some reporting on Mink the Bear. Mink had become used to eating human food because a man in the Upper Valley was feeding her. After he died, she was getting too close to humans, so she was relocated to the North Country. NHPR's Brita Green, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Peter.
So what's Mink's status right now? First of all, thank you for reporting on Mink. The story is so good. What's going on with Mink now?
Well, Mink has officially made it home, which is a big deal. So it's been almost a year since she was relocated to the North Country, and she's traveled. It's not obviously thousands of miles between where she was dropped off and Hanover, but she's sort of made this looping path, and she's traveled thousands of miles along that path trying to get back across Interstate 91 and the Connecticut River, and it was unclear if she was going to make it. She's been sort of within striking range for a while, but she has made it home this week. So we'll have to see what happens now that she's back in Hanover.
And is she okay? Is she healthy? How's she doing?
I don't know. The last I've heard is that she was doing well. She didn't have cubs last season as she was on the road, but there is a question of whether she'll breed this spring and have another round of cubs.
Mm-hmm. And how do Fish and Game or any other officials manage her? I mean, are they worried that she's going to start interacting with human populations again?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big concern. They're saying basically we're going to take it day by day, and that they're treating her just like any other bear and hoping that she behaves like any other bear, sort of stays in the woods and doesn't get back into dumpsters and like, get back into, you know, fraternity house recycling bins and things like that. Whether that is actually going to happen, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Is it even possible for a bear to sort of unlearn those bad habits or forget the taste of a maple glazed donut that she'd been used to?
I think the thinking is that once a bear learns to associate humans with food and learns to be comfortable around humans, they're not going to unlearn that behavior. What Hanover has done, though, has done a remarkable job of communicating with residents in town and getting them to, both residents and college students and things like that, to really be much better at making sure their dumpsters aren't overflowing with trash, making sure everything's secured, sort of taking down bird feeders. So the hope is that there's just less things attracting her to problem areas, so it's just less likely that it's going to happen.
Well, Brita, while we have you with us, I want you to talk a little bit about the late poet Donald Hall. But before we do that, I want to play something that you helped produce this week. So there was the estate sale at Eagle Pond Farm, the homestead of poet Donald Hall. Hundreds of people showed up to collect mementos of his life, and you had them read his poem, The Things, and I want to hear a little bit of that first.
Donald Hall's The Things.
When I walk in my house, I see pictures bought long ago.
Framed and hanging, de Kooning, Arp, Lorenzen, Henry Moore.
That I've cherished and stared at for years.
Yet my eyes keep returning to the masters of the trivial.
A white stone, perfectly round, tiny lead models of baseball players.
A cowbell, a broken great-grandmother's rocker. A dead dog's toy.
valueless, unforgettable detritus that my children will throw away.
As I did my mother's souvenirs of trips with my dead father.
Kodaks of kittens.
And bundles of cards from her mother, Kate.
So NHPR's Brita Green producing a community reading, it seems, of Donald Hall's poem, The Things. How did it go at his estate sale, Brita? You were there. What was it like?
Yeah, so just to paint a picture, I mean, I got there about 15 minutes before the doors were slated to open at 9 a.m. It was a sort of clearing Saturday morning, so there it had been a little rainy and the sun was just starting to peek out, and there were hundreds of people there already, sort of weaving in a line from the front door of this old farmhouse across the lawn and then going almost down the street. And the first people in line, they told me they had gotten there actually at 6 o'clock the night before, and they'd stayed out there all night long just to make sure that they could be the first people into the house. So it was quite a scene, and some people were sort of more emotional. Either they were big fans of Hall's work or were personal friends of his or of Jane Kenyon's, his late wife. Some people, though, were just sort of like people that go to estate sales all the time and had no idea who Donald Hall was. So it was this interesting mix of people just sort of waiting there to get into the house.
And as you reported this week, Brita, the house is going to be preserved, right? In some way, it's not just going to be sold and converted into something else.
Right. So this is very much still up in the air. What happened was a group of people who were either friends of Hall's or Jane Kenyon's, as I said, or fans of their work or sort of work in preservation in some way in New Hampshire, heard that the house was going to go on the market. And they were like, we don't want that to happen. You know, what's going to happen to it? So one couple actually contacted the realtor and found out how much the house was selling for, and they felt so personally like this was such a big, important thing to them that they actually put down their own money and bought the house. And their hope is that ultimately they're going to be able to figure something out where they can sell it back, so they're not going to lose a ton of money on this, and just sell it to a group or somehow get it into permanent preservation. But exactly what that looks like is unclear.
NHPR's Brita Green, her reporting on this and on Mink the Bear can be found at nhpr.org. Thanks very much. We really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And in the few minutes we have remaining, I want to ask our panelists what they'll be looking forward to in the coming week. Let's start with you, Anna Brown.
Well, next week, the House and Senate are voting on some of those voter registration bills, as well as gun restriction bills, expanding background checks, mandatory waiting period. Should be a hot one.
Gary, what do you think?
I think the budget's going to start heating up in the Senate. That's going to be something to watch.
And Dean?
Saturday at 3 p.m. at the Barley House in Concord, I'm going to be sitting down with Governor Jay Inslee of Washington, presidential candidate focused on climate change, to do a Pints and Politics interview with him.
Ooh, live interviews are fun.
I'm very excited.
Well, thank you very much, everybody, for being here today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
Good to be here.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Gary Reno, author of Distant Dome, a Manchester InkLink and in-depth NH.org series that explores stories from the State House. And Anna Brown, director of research and analysis at Citizens Count. This has been The Exchange. And remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brinley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky. Dan Tuohy is working the cameras today, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.